and homemade soups for lunch, or burgers and hand-dipped shakes for dinner, the Courier Cafe in downtown Urbana has been offering fresh choices for 28 years.
It's 2:40 in sports. One of the marks of Illinois' defense last season was its ability to force interceptions. The Illini picked off 17 passes last year, but have only 3 so far this season. Illinois coach Ron Zook says the Illini aren't doing anything different this year that would account for the drop. The Illini face off against Wisconsin tomorrow in Madison. The Chicago Bulls play their last preseason game tonight when they take on Milwaukee at the United Center. The Bucks are led by former Bulls coach Scott Skiles, and they've gone 1-6 in exhibition play. Chicago is 3-4 in the preseason. The St. Louis Blues will try to regroup from a tough loss Wednesday when they face off against the Los Angeles Kings tonight. The Blues held a 3-1-0 advantage over the Kings in last season's series, taking both contests at Scott Trade Center. Tonight, vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin is slated to drop the ceremonial first puck at Scott Trade Center. And there will be a new venue for the World Series when play resumes tomorrow night. The best of seven series has moved from St. Petersburg, Florida, to Philadelphia. The Phillies and Rays split the first two games, and the next three are scheduled for Philly. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trivet Mansion across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
A new survey has uncovered a little secret of American doctors. Many prescribe pills that don't have any specific effect on the illness of the patient. In other words, placebos. Harmless pills that the patient is supposed to think are real medicine. NPR's Richard Knox has more.
Placebos are common in medical research. One group of volunteers gets a test drug, the other group a look-alike sugar pill. Everybody's told up front they could get one or the other. But the new survey is about placebos in everyday medical care without patients' knowledge. The idea is that if the patient thinks the pill will help, it might. The survey results are in the current issue of the British Medical Journal. Of nearly 700 U.S. internal medicine doctors and arthritis specialists surveyed, half said they regularly prescribe placebos for conditions that haven't responded to treatment, like chronic pain or fatigue. Most often it's a vitamin pill or over-the-counter painkiller, although some prescribe an antibiotic or sedative, which could be harmful. Typically, doctors tell patients the placebo is potentially helpful but not designed for your specific illness. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is head of ethics at the National Institutes of Health and a study author.
Half of all American internists and rheumatologists using placebos was a real surprise to me. I was pretty astonished.
Dr. Howard Brody was surprised, too. He's an expert on placebos at the University of Texas in Galveston. He didn't have anything to do with the survey, but he says it shows how much doctors' attitudes have changed over the past few decades.
For many, many, many years, the typical reaction of a physician was, well, real doctors don't prescribe placebos. A placebo is a fake medicine, so only a quack would prescribe a placebo.
Since the 1960s, the dominant ethic among U.S. physicians has been patient autonomy. It means the patient's in charge. He's entitled to know everything about his care. But if many doctors are handing out placebos, that's at odds with this ethic, Emanuel says.
On the one hand, if we have placebos and they work and they make people feel good, we're advancing, promoting people's health and promoting their welfare. If it requires us to deceive them, we're undermining autonomy.
The American Medical Association recognizes the dilemma. 2 years ago, it adopted a policy that the use of a placebo without a patient's knowledge can undermine trust and even result in medical harm. Robert Sade, a South Carolina surgeon, was chair of the AMA's Ethics Council when the new policy was adopted.
Physicians who use placebos are not being, quote, unethical, end quote, but they're skirting on the edges of ethical behavior.
The AMA says if doctors want to use placebos, they should tell patients that one or more of the pills they're getting is not specifically designed for their illness, but some have found it helpful. Studies have shown that placebos sometimes do help people who expect them to work.
The physician would tell the patient, I'm going to give you these two medications. I want you to take this red pill for a month and record your symptoms. And I want you to take the blue pill for a month and record your symptoms in a log.
It's sort of a little experiment involving a single patient. Either or both pills could be placebos. But some say this is just a more elaborate kind of deception. Again, Ezekiel Emanuel, the NIH ethics chief.
I think we're all just a little nervous about that as a common practice. So even though it might be on the right side of deception, we're not being fully frank with the patient.
Emanuel doesn't condemn all placebo use. After all, he says, it shows that American doctors understand that the mind plays a big role in healing. And that's not a bad thing. Richard Knox, NPR News.
It's 2:47. Everyone is spending much more energy these days, and the University of Illinois is no exception. Curbing the cost is just one goal of a new Office of Sustainability on the Urbana campus. It's meant to draft and supervise new conservation efforts, but also to reduce the amount of pollution the university creates, whether it's exhaust from Abbott Power Plant or old computers. The office's first director is Richard Warner, a wildlife ecology professor and formerly an administrator in the College of ACES. He recently told AM580's Tom Rogers that his first priority is simply to take stock of all the programs already in place.
There are a couple of words that are very important here. One is communicate, and another is coordinate. There are already many really creative, important projects underway on this campus right now. Those range from activities that our facilities and services operation have to
these
research.
Are things such as recycling.
Exactly. And we're recycling right now about half of what we could, but those have been very impressive steps in the last few years. We're doing very creative things in some of our dorms in terms of local foods, in terms of experimenting with energy use and behavior, and what kinds of behavior can really significantly affect that. And almost any leaf that you turn over at this university, there are important creative things going on. So that's why in the early stages, communicate and coordinate will really be important here.
To what extent do you have to further sustainability on campus? Is this something that you have to set specific goals for?
Yes.
A higher percentage of recycling, more
yes.
locally grown foods, that sort of thing.
And the specific goals that we will set will probably be a year or so out. That's exactly what we're talking about now. But I can give you one example of a goal that this campus has already set. By 2011, we would like to reduce our energy, our electricity use by 10%. By around 2016, we would like to reduce that by 20%. So there are instances where we have specific goals in mind, and we have impressive early steps in looking at how we can achieve that. And just focusing in on energy again for a minute here, right now there are about 80 buildings on this campus from which about 90% of our building-related energy consumption is attributed to. And we're actually now metering those buildings, beginning to understand the performance of those buildings, and in some cases, thinking about where are those places where we can make modest investments and get quick gains in terms of energy conservation. And there's actually been an early success story in that. The Krannert Center was retro-commissioned with some ways in which we've improved energy efficiency, and that project cost about $188,000, and we calculate that within the first maybe 6 months or so, we will have more than recovered that investment. So those kinds of early steps are under consideration.
What kind of pressure will the U of I be facing from the state, from other agencies, to make progress on sustainability, to reduce electric use, to reduce greenhouse gas, gas emissions, water usage, and the like?
I think there are maybe two forms of expectations from the state, probably more than that. One would be, okay, University of Illinois, as an important contributor to greenhouse emissions, what are you going to do? And I think that we are positioning ourselves to be a leader, to creatively address those. You know, it is well known that our energy costs are very high. If you go back to 2003, this campus had an energy cost of around $26 million. I believe that was mainly around buildings. Within two fiscal years, that had doubled. We project that energy cost could be around $70 million in this coming year. So one expectation that Illinois taxpayers have is University of Illinois, use as many resources as you can to be about your mission with students, with research and teaching. And so that's an expectation that we have. But I think there's another one that's very important here too, and that is how we begin to identify and demonstrate new technologies, new ways of behaving around these issues that communities can benefit from as well. We look for careful partnerships with our surrounding region and communities. We look for careful partnerships with communities of practice. Even the city of Chicago is talking a lot with our campus about how we can contribute to some of sustainability issues in that particular setting. So we want to lead this both in terms of our own actions and behavior, but also in how we look at these issues and begin to help Illinois in a much wider way deploy what we can do here.
Dick Warner is the University of Illinois' first director of the Office of Sustainability. He talked with AM 580's Tom Rogers. It's 2:53. The International Monetary Fund this month released a bleak outlook for the economic growth of the U.S. and many European countries in 2009. The IMF estimates the U.S. economy will grow by 0.1%, and for countries like Spain, England, and Italy, the IMF projects a probable recession. Under the current EU presidency of France, the European Union is working hard on getting its economies back on track. AM 580's Michael Kaliska talked to French ambassador to the U.S., Pierre Vimond, as he visited the University of Illinois Urbana campus. Vimond says currently Europe is working on three fronts to solve the problem.
First of all, we have to stop this crisis as much as possible. You see, try to put some water on the fire, which amounts for the total of the European Union above 1,500 billion euros. So that's a lot of money. The second thing after that is to look at what could be the implications for the real economy and if we're going to have a slowdown and even maybe a recession. So we have already started having exchanges of view between the members of the European Union to see what kind of policy we should try to adopt in each of our countries. And thirdly, it's to look on the longer term and to look at what could be the reform of the financial system in terms of better control, better surveillance of the market, common rules and regulation on rating agencies, etc.
But do you feel that there maybe is going to be some conflict in between the perception of regulation from the EU side and the US side?
No, I think it's a question of balance, of finding the right balance. We all are in favor of keeping the free market. Nicolas Sarkozy, when he went last Saturday to Camp David, said so, that he agreed that he didn't want to get rid of capitalism. On the contrary, he wants to get back to the basics and the fundamentals of what was the real capitalistic system, which was not a system whereby you were more in a casino than in a real capitalist system.
Are there already plans how to collaborate with the United States?
collaboration has already started. For instance, the meeting in Camp David Saturday between President Bush, President Sarkozy, and President Barroso, which means a meeting between the United States on one side, Europe on the other side, is a clear testimony to that kind of cooperation we want to have.
In 2 weeks, there's going to be an election here. What do you expect from a new administration?
For France and for Europe, I think, is to give a new momentum to the transatlantic partnership. We are at a time where both the United States on one side, the European Union on the other side, are facing the same kind of challenges, and those are tremendous. And we won't find a solution on our own. We need to work together and try to find together how to proceed with those challenges, non-proliferation, the fight against terrorism, very specific issues as Afghanistan, Africa and Darfur, and on all those issues, we have to work together. And Europe is ready to work together with the United States, because Europe, as it goes on and as it completes its building, its construction, wants to play a great role in world affairs and is ready to do that.
You mentioned a lot of what is important is a dialogue. And with what possible future administration do you think Europe can have the best dialogue?
Oh, we intend to dialogue with both, whoever wins the election. You know, I won't get into promoting one or the other candidate. It's not my role as a French diplomat. But you can be sure, and the foreign ministers have already discussed that in one of their informal meetings. They will discuss again at the end of this month in Paris. They want to have their position ready with regard to a transatlantic partnership before the next administration is in place, in order to be able to start that dialogue as quickly as possible.
Pierre Vimond became French ambassador to the U.S. in August of last year. Before that, he was chief of staff for the French foreign minister and worked as France's permanent representative at the EU.
Earth and Sky.
I'm Deborah Bird. Most of today's robots are powered by motors or batteries. But like any electrical device, a robot's energy runs out quickly, and the robot has to be plugged in to recharge. Now, scientists are developing fuel-powered artificial muscles to free robots from the wall socket. Here's Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson with more.
Ray Bachman, director of the Nanotech Institute at UT Dallas, is steering humanoid robots towards a power system that mimics our own human muscles. Just as we convert our fuel, food, into chemical energy, Bachman envisions a future where a shot of high-density fuel will reinvigorate a robot's energy.
So I understand these robot muscles are made on the nano scale.
Right. The artificial